Hello and welcome to
Hello.
Hello. Hello. I was on a real nice up vibe there.
I thought that one was going to be good as well.
Hello and welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast with me, your host Adam Richmond, and joining me as ever, Mr. Joe Devine.
Hi there.
Oh, you used to squawk like a chicken. You feeling poorly?
Yeah, I'm ill.
On today's episode, we are going to be talking about the 2005 comic book adaptation, V for Vendetta, directed by James McTeague, from a screenplay by the Wachowskis, lest we forget.
Was it really? I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
Fascinating. It is a bit Matrix-y, isn't it?
Oh, mate, is it? And they were, I think they wanted to direct it, but then they passed it off to the director James McTeague, who they'd worked with on other bits and bobs. It's a shockingly long 132 mins. And here is the letterboxed. People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people. In a world in which Great Britain has become a fascist state, a masked vigilante known only as V conducts guerrilla warfare against the oppressive British government. When V rescues a young woman from the secret police, he finds in her an ally with whom he can continue his fight to free the people of Britain. That young woman is played by Natalie Portman. V himself is voiced by Hugo Weaving. And we also have a Stephen Fry, a Stephen Ray. And
probably Ray, is it Ray?
Ray. And we also have a cast of so many British faces, many off-puttingly British faces. And that's what we're going to chat about today. You got me on this because I left you an open goal because I had genuinely had forgotten this flick and everything from it.
Yeah.
Apart from obviously the mask. You love this film.
Do you know what? I do like it. But I think watching it this time, I was watching it with a different pair of eyes, Adam, because I was watching it with your eyes and I was kind of wincing every time I saw something where I was like, oh, he's going to hate that. Or this bit is, if he was here, he'd go, oh, and pause the film and then explain something to me. So I feel like this viewing, I saw bits of this film that I thought, yeah, that's not great. But overall, really enjoy the themes. So yeah, I don't want this to become a, I like it, you don't like it. But I think thematically, it's a good one for me. But you're very, very right wing, so you don't like it at all.
Ha 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 ha. I love that. I always hated suggesting to watch a film to people when I was younger and sitting with them. Because I just felt so exposed and I could never just enjoy watching it because I would just constantly be thinking, what are they thinking of this bit? Are they enjoying this?
Yeah.
So I just stopped doing it. I do a bit better now. But like even if it was a new film, like, you know, say, oh, come. That's going back to inviting people to the cinema. I feel like for a long time I felt so responsible. I had nothing to do with the film, not anything to do with me. And yet I felt like if they weren't enjoying themselves, it was somehow on me. So you've basically had that experience all by yourself.
Yeah.
You've watched the film and then you've been with me. I love it.
And I have to say, spending some time there, what did you say, 132 minutes in your shoes, in the back of your head, watching through your hazel eyes. It's so much better being me, I have to say, because the things that you noticed when you were watching this film through my eyes, wait, hang on, through my eyes, but that were your eyes, are things that I've never noticed before and that don't matter to my enjoyment of the film.
This is amazing. Please tell me what I noticed through your eyes.
So you noticed that...
what did I notice?
What you noticed through my eyes was A... Natalie Portman's English accent is not very good. Okay, I can promise you.
Hello. What's going? I'm gonna go out. What's going on here? Oh, I've. What's going? I promise I'm gonna go home. Oh, governor, blimey. Oh, it's not that bad, but it...
No, it's not as bad as that.
It finds... We'll get to the midpoint. It does... At some point, it does sort of find its feet, but for the first hour and 20 minutes...
It's ropey.
It's god-awful.
And but can I tell you, I promise you, while I know that to be true, I've never, hand on heart, noticed that before when it's just me looking through my eyes. When it's just me and I'm the only person in my eyes, I've never noticed that because it doesn't matter to me. And this film is you know, it's a cinematic experience. It's fantastical. It could be set in a different world, right? So I grew up reading a lot of fantasy books and watching a lot of fantasy and sci-fi where a lot of accents are ropey as hell and you get a lot of people doing strange English for anything historical or anyone on a horse with a wand. It's always English. So I think I'm quite used to that American English middle ground thing.
But she really tries to be both plummy and also kind of common. It's really interesting because it's actually a charming failure. And I was really over egging how bad it was. It is bad, but also it's admirably bad because you can see the work that she's tried to do. She's tried to get a very specific accent. She hasn't just gone
RP or anything.
I mean, you know, it goes both ways. When I was chatting to, you know, Ricky Young about Jason Statham and Gerard Butler and them trying to do American accents, the reason why I don't enjoy them when they so much is because they really, that you can see them thinking so hard about trying to do an American accent. And it's basically takes up about 80% of their performance. When those two are both such charismatic actors, when they're just doing their own accent, whenever they just have to do this rubbish, bland American thing that doesn't, no one speaks like that.
Yeah, I agree.
You just see her for the first hour and 20 minutes, and that runtime is very important. First hour and 20 minutes, she is spending so much of her effort trying to speak in that sort of ludicrously overworked accent. And it's kind of unfortunate. She's a great actress, but it's such a flat, boring, monotone performance
Because of the accent.
The accent.
No, I agree for sure. And I will say on accents that I think my usual rule with accents when an actor is doing a non-native accent to themselves and not doing a very good job is, in most films, I think, just do your own accent. It's fine. It doesn't matter. You know, it's completely irrelevant. Whereas in this film, that literally does not work. It's inconceivable for her character to be American.
I feel bad because... I'm going to jump ahead we'll get to the next bit. But the reason why I feel bad is because she gives the most stunning performance an hour and 20 into the film.
Yeah.
After there's a sequence where she is seemingly taken by the authorities, brutalized and tortured. And she finds solace in this secret story that's been written in the walls. It's a fantastic sequence. The fact that I've had to wait an hour and 20 minutes to see that is unforgivable. But anyway, and as I was watching it, I had a vague memory. I was thinking, hang on a sec, isn't this V who does this? But I was watching, thinking, well, this is obviously the baddies are doing this. That's how much I'd forgotten. Anyway, it's a beautiful sequence, beautifully harrowing sequence, and it kind of has this amazing story that she's reading, and it's a great LGBTQ story about, you know, understanding and tolerance and how people try and how they are, you know, brutalized by horrible governments and people. And at the end of that, it comes out and it turns out this was V. He's been doing it to her all along. And the performance that she gives when she breaks down is, it almost took my breath away. It's amazing. It's an amazingly written scene. It's an amazing sequence. It's a stunning performance. she's not really got the accent anymore, but it's all a pure emotion. And I was just thinking, where was this? Natalie Portman is such a stunning, she's so good. And the film has robbed her of expressing that for the whole first hour and 20 minutes. And my first thought was, can one amazing scene save a shit film?
Yes.
We don't have to answer that now.
Yes.
Do you want to go back and should we go back and then tell me what was the next thing I saw through your eyes?
No, I want to stay on Portman for a moment if I can, because I think you're right. It's a really fantastic scene. I think one of the problems with the Natalie Portman character, and to be fair, these are other things that I saw through your eyes. These are other things that you saw through my eyes that my own eyes hadn't seen before. But when you were looking through them, they saw them suddenly. I think the viewer has to do a little bit of work to finesse the Portman character. It's very important that that you do as a viewer of this film, because when you get to experience her rebirth and her, you know, ideological letting go of fear, it's a terrific moment. But, you know, the funny thing about the character is that she's sort of coincidentally rescued by V at the beginning of this film, and then is kind of dragged along the plot through an association with him that she didn't really choose at any point. But because of the character's backstory, that is that her parents were political and were killed, and that her brother was killed in a government hospital, because of her backstory, the police characters who were looking for her and looking for V immediately assumed that it wasn't a coincidence and that she was there purposefully and that she has some role to play because of her history. And that's really fun. That's a great dichotomy that the film displays. And also, it never really reveals that either. There's a great meeting at the end between Portman and Stephen Ray, who's the sort of lead detective on the case. And there's no explanation in the film that narrative wasn't ever really correct. It doesn't matter by the time that you get there. She may as well have been part of the plot from the beginning, you know. But I think when I'm watching it, I do a little bit of work to feel what she might be feeling when she's having her rebirth scene, when V is telling her, stay with this. This could be the most important moment of your life. Think about what they did to your parents. Think about what they did to your brother. And you see it in her performance in that moment. You don't see it at any point beforehand in the film. Beforehand, it's very unclear. It's not clear, really, why she's the kind of person that would leave the house after quarantine. There's nothing really in her character that displays that she would be someone that would take those kinds of risks. There's nothing that really explains why she goes with V in the first place, how she ends up in all these different situations. There's a little bit maybe to explain why when she bumps into V again at various different points in the story that she helps him instead of helping herself. But the character isn't fleshed out at all. And maybe that's a success of the writing because it allows the viewer to be engaged in it. Maybe it's a bit of a failure that there isn't more there for us to get hold of. I don't know. What do you think that's better or worse? Because I feel like it's a sort of criticism that I might levy against a film that does too much of that work to like spoon feed it to me, you know?
It's done zero work. And I think I'd read passing mention how James McTeague and the studios kind of took the film away from the Wachowskis and heavily re-edited it. It feels like a film told out of order.
Yeah.
And it feels quite clumsily plotted, and the storytelling for the first hour is so jarring. The time jumps are not signposted and are inexcusably long or short. You have there's no sense of what a cut means in terms of how much time has passed.
Because the film takes place over the course of one calendar year.
That's too long. If you read any script writing book, you know, a good film should be set over a fairly kind of punchy amount of time. A great film is set over one day. Any great film, you name a film, it's set over one day.
The Matrix.
The Matrix is set over about a week.
No.
It's not over set over a day.
It's sort of more like a 2 weeks. Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, but, you know, don't say shit films. Say
okay,
good
hold
films.
On. Let me say another good film.
no, to be... I was being facetious. With Lord of the Rings...
The Hunt for Red October.
That's basically a day. But listen, Lord of the Rings that. Is in... The only... My problem with... And my problem... A problem with the Lord of the Rings films is they have so far to walk.
Yeah.
And but they walk... Via montage.
Yeah, yeah, I love a montage walk.
Yeah, but like, you know, we must walk many miles across the mountains of... And at least they sell it in a montage, but it's just like, well, your montage has just done the work there.
Yeah, whereas there's not really any montages in... There's a couple in this one, but, you know...
There's these rubbish cutaways to normal British families watching the telly together.
The same three.
Cut to the pub. Cut to the weird family.
The weird family with the girl, yeah.
And the man with big teeth.
Yeah.
And then there's one other cutaway. It's like, I don't want to get off topic, but this film looks so cheap.
Well, we're going to come to that with the box office game.
But yeah, but honestly, it looks... like shit, this film.
It made me think the whole notion of film criticism is absolutely pointless, because if you don't like a film, it just means you've watched it at the wrong time.
You know, there's some fun V-facts. Do you want to know the fun V-facts?
I'd love to know some fun V-facts. I feel like I'm talking about the vagina, though, when I say that. I don't know if that's... I want to know some facts. Can you... How does the vagina work?
Hey, I don't know that. But I can tell you some fun facts about the character V in the film V for Vendetta.
That would be preferable.
I feel like these are very well known... But the actor James Purefoy was the original actor behind the mask, and a lot of his stuff is still in the film.
Uh-huh.
But he got sick of it, basically. He said, fuck this, I can't act behind this mask. So they got in Hugo Weaving, who the Wachowskis had obviously worked with on the aforementioned Matrix. And then there's a couple of stunt guys as well, who were all in there, and obviously, and Hugo Weaving is responsible for the voice.
He's good though, isn't he? He's got a good voice, Weavers.
He does. It's initially very ponderous and like, man, this is Agent Smith. And I thought that was going to be the thing that I hated and was annoyed about the most. But it works. And there is something to that. The more you stare at that mask, that stupid expression.
Yeah, the more you see the emotion, for sure.
You do start to imprint on it.
Very much so. It works for me, 100%.
The potential, I just see nothing but like, man, this could have been so much more. They had so much. It feels like they've got the beginnings of, I feel like I'm watching the rough cut. The music is rubbish and generic and like offcuts of the Matrix, and the action is woefully shot and woefully done until the finale when V goes to town on some baddies. But generally it's just
when he finger bangs the finger men.
It's a bit over eggs the slow-mo, but at least we've got some blood splatter and it's stylized.
It's knifey.
But yet it feels very much, this is, again, I'm yearning for something. Like going back to Alan Moore, I think what I was asking, because I know this is what you're an expert on, the author of the text disowns the text, the film text, and says, this is not mine. This has got nothing to do with me. I want my name off it. It doesn't reflect the story that I told.
Yeah.
You're big death of the author kind of guy.
That's right. I am Roland Barthes.
Don't you think the guy who knows his story the best is the guy who wrote it?
No.
The smartest.
Oh, you weren't finished. Sorry. I'll say no at the end when you're finished.
I know you're going to say no. This is a rhetorical question. Try not to say no.
Uh-huh.
Try to...
Not say anything. That's what you want at the end of a rhetorical
question. No, I want you
question.
To say something else. I want you to kind of soak it in.
And then say something other than no. Okay.
Try and try and pivot off into a thought.
So what you're saying is like, what would I say if you were saying it in my mouth?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, I'll do that, yeah.
Why doesn't he know the text better?
This would be my perspective on this, and I'm going to sort of work around the question that you asked me, because it was a very laboured question. Having said that, because you've said it and I heard it, it's no longer yours, so you don't have to feel any guilt about it or any responsibility, because what I heard and interpreted as what you were saying is actually my question, and that's why I'm going to answer that one instead, because you're dead as the author of your own question. Does that answer your question?
That's amazing. You've done it.
Good.
I tell you what, my favorite. Do you want to know what my favorite bit was
of the film V for Vendetta?
Well, not my favorite bit, but the bit that I thought was funniest.
I'd love to know what you thought was funniest about this film. Which bit?
The funniest bit. I almost cracked up laughing. it's also in the most powerful section.
Yeah.
I'm laughing just thinking about it.
Listen to you go. How could it possibly live up to this?
As powerful as the section is when Natalie Portman is reading the story of the woman who was put in prison for being gay.
Yeah.
It is powerful. It's also a bit hokey. And there's this amazing bit where...
Is it with the rat?
No. Oh, she talks about... And the young... I tell you, I spotted this. The young actress who plays the young woman,
Valerie.
The young Valerie. Imogen Poots, which obviously means nothing to you.
Okay, I'm just looking at... I'm just going to try and find... young Valerie, Imogen Poots.
Fantastic in 28 weeks later. 28 weeks later, she's in, and she's
Which one's she?
She's the kid.
Oh, she's from Skins.
I'd never watched that. She's fantastic actress. She's really funny and...
I should just check that she's from Skins. Hold on.
Spiky. I don't think she is from Skins. I've she's really from 28 weeks later, and she's in a film called Vivarium with Jesse Eisenberg.
Oh, she's in this TV series that I watched, Outer Range. She's quite good in that.
Oh, shall I watch that?
No, you shouldn't. No.
Okay.
You won't like it.
Anyway, young Valerie is... this is flashback mode. And old Valerie is writing about her coming out story and how harrowing it is.
It is sad, that bit.
It's really sad. But then there's a bit... It's all kind of done in this blurry, flashbacky... schlocky type vibe.
Yeah.
And she says how she's telling her dad, and the dad throws a framed picture of a baby in the bin. And the camera holds on this. It's a framed picture of a baby in a bin.
Okay.
It's the most fucking ludicrous thing I've ever seen. It's like,
so guys, what could listen, we really need to get, because the dad, you're not going to hear him, you're going to hear VO at this point in the film. So what could the dad do, guys, that really drives the point home? Now remember, we all here are straight, obviously, so we don't actually know, but what could the dad do that could really drive the point home?
Listen, we're talking pure cinema, guys. Pure cinema. We've got voiceover. Okay, we've already got the actress.
Yes, there'll be music, of course. That's going to get the tears jerking,
stirring, jerking. But we need a visual, guys.
Punchy.
What would you do?
What if could he write gay on the wall and cross it off? What about that? Could he do that? Or maybe he could find a men's health magazine and put it in the fire. Is there anything else?
Would he hit his daughter? No, you're right. That is too much.
Yeah.
He could punch a mirror. We're in the living room. He could kick something.
Could he chop his penis off? I think that could play.
You know what, guys? I think we're getting off topic. We want something that visualizes his literal rejection of his daughter.
Oh, I've got it.
We need to visualize that's what the scene is.
Simon,
go back to the script.
What about...
That's what the scene is.
On the mantelpiece.
Yeah.
You know how ordinary people, not like us, have pictures of family on the mantelpiece?
Yes.
What if he found a picture of her and he threw it on the floor? What do you think about that?
On the floor? But, I mean...
Is that not enough?
I mean, it could shatter on the floor. I mean, what are you talking about? Who, like, what age is she in this picture?
Well, what age do you think she should be?
I mean, maybe the age that she is. Is it too obvious if she's at the same age that she is in the scene? Or is that confusing?
The audience will think if it's just a picture of her that they've taken the picture on the same day and printed it. You know what people get like with photographs in films?
Maybe they'll think it's a magical mirror.
Yeah, yeah. They might think he's smashing a mirror and then they'll think he's gay.
Yes, though, that's okay. So it's got to be younger. 10, maybe? I mean, you're framing the... Is it framed? Because it's on the mantelpiece. It's got to be framed.
It's not just a photograph. It's a framed photo.
Do you frame... I mean, most framed photos, they tend to involve everyone in the family. Is that too confusing?
No. Say it with me now, because you know where I'm going.
Yeah.
What if she was a baby? A baby. You knew I was going to say it. I knew you were going to say it. That's it. Stick it in. She's a baby. Throw it in the bin.
There is... the fantastic scene, as discussed with Natalie Portman, post-brutalization.
Yeah.
It's one of her finest moments in one of her finest. It would be there in the final reel. It's stunning. There's another fantastic moment. There's one other fantastic moment in this film. And I want to come back to, I asked this question, you didn't answer it. There's a fantastic moment towards the end where Stephen Ray is sitting in his office. And it's like the gauntlet has been laid down, Seymour the policeman, and Rupert Graves says, well, what do you think's going to happen? I think all the masks have been sent out.
Yeah.
And Stephen Ray gives the most amazing monologue.
Yeah.
I'd love to just drop it in here now. Stephen Ray's a fantastic actor.
He's terrific in this.
He's wasted mostly for this, but he really delivers this monologue.
He whispers everything under his breath without whispering. Like, I don't know how he does that with his mouth, but he just speaks it out of the little bottom right corner in a totally believable way that completely builds an enormous character without really any any lines in there that allow him to do that, right? What I feel I know about him as a person just from the way that he talks... it's so much. Like, he does such a good job.
And again, you're kind of thinking, I feel like I'm seeing an echo, a whisper of the film that this could be in that. Because there's some fantastic writing in here and there's some great actors. And my question is that enough to save a film?
Oh, that's the question.
That's not rhetorical. You like this film. You buy into this film.
Yeah.
Imagine another film. Can you think of another film, one or two scenes that are so good and disproportionately amazing to the surrounding guff that have made you sit up and go, well, hang on, I'm going to give this film a pass. Am I just inventing a new category?
No, not at all. Not 100% exists. And funnily enough, I watched another one of those films this week. And that's Rogue One, the spin-off star, you know, the kind of it's not a spin-off, the Star Wars film, not part of the trilogy, but one of the one-off films. For those listeners who haven't seen it or who have forgotten, it's the story of how the Death Star blueprints came to be in the possession of the rebels, and that's what makes it a terrific film, by the way. But it exists definitely in this category. Most of it. It's very, very boring. There's a very long way to get to the interesting bits. The characters never really gel. And similarly to V for Vendetta, sometimes you kind of have to do a bit of work yourself in order to get maximum enjoyment out of it. But in this film, Rogue One, it brings me to tears when I watch it, Adam, because of the notion of sacrifice, the sacrifice that these various characters make who aren't even going to be mentioned in the franchise movies, but the sacrifice that they make in order for one small detail of a bigger picture to be brought together. And there are one or two scenes in that film where that point is kind of driven home. That's the central thesis of the film, and it sings in those moments, and it does that despite... I would say 80% of the film being just about getting to those moments and being very boring, you know, and that's kind of, it's not dissimilar to V for Vendetta. I enjoy the rest of V for Vendetta more. I prefer V for Vendetta as a film. And I think similarly, it sings at the moments that it does. Like every time a big explosion goes off and the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da music goes, like, it definitely gets me. It wins me over every time. The previous hour might as well have been completely nothing. The TV might as well have been off. And if that turns on, it will get me. It's like watching a music video where you've no context for what's happening in the music video, but there's just something about the timbre of it or the performance of it that just gets you going. You know, it's why people cry at John Lewis adverts.
No, but they cry at those adverts having not seen them. You're crying at V for Vendetta because you're bringing with it your existing experiences with it, and you're knowing your emotions are already tumescent.
I'm doing the work on behalf of the film, and I'm okay for that. And like, I naturally do that when I watch a film like that that kind of hits with themes that would be organically interesting to me. And in this case, the idea of oppression and of eventually saying no is a very compelling theme. It's a really compelling story in any film. It's why I love Lord of the Rings. It's why I love Harry Potter. It's, you know, it's why I like Star Wars, right? It's not any different from those things. It's just executed really well, I think.
It's great that you brought up Star Wars, because in both Star Wars and V for Vendetta, you are seeing a large populace overturn a horrible fascist regime.
Yeah.
Wow, I had never thought about that the two could be equated. Now, at the end of the Star Wars films, at the end of Return of the Jedi...
Which one's that? Is that the new one, or...?
No. We're talking,
the originals.
The Holy Trilogy.
Okay.
Nothing else counts.
Okay.
Prequels don't count. The last whatever three those were, they don't count.
They're sequels.
Yeah, but whatever they are, they're sequel. But then Empire Strikes Back is a sequel. I wouldn't refer to the final three chapters as... They're not anything to do with anything.
Okay.
No. They're nothing. Yeah, those films are nothing.
Sure. I like them.
For the purposes of this anyway, like, you know.
Yeah, in the context of this conversation. I understand what you're saying.
With Return of the Jedi, end of Return of the Jedi, and some of these scenes were added for the 1996 re-release that they did. The end of they're on the Ewok planet, and they've done it. The rebels have won, and you cut to all these celebrations across the galaxy.
Yes.
Now, at the end of that film, I'm not thinking, I wonder what they're all going to do now. I wonder what the world looks like now that they've defeated Darth Vader and the Emperor and they've blown up the Death Star.
Yes.
I imagine that they are going to continue with their day-to-day lives. Now, at the end of this film, V for Vendetta, when V has exploded the Houses of Parliament, or is it Big Ben? Houses of Parliament?
Well, it's both. Big Ben is attached. Big Ben is the clock face, which is attached to the tower, which is attached to the Houses of Parliament.
Is it?
Yeah, it's all one building.
Big Ben's the bell, isn't it? As everyone always likes to say.
Isn't it the, whoever isn't says it, that, is it the bell or is it the clock?
No, wait a minute.
I think it's the clock face.
No. Let me finish my stupid joke.
You finish your joke.
People who say...
Who? People who?
People who say Big Ben's the bell.
Yeah.
They're the fucking bell.
Oh. I think Big Ben's the clock, though, so I don't know
no,
if you...
No. Big Ben is the name of the bell.
Is it?
Yeah, it's not the name of the clock.
Look what I've managed to get you to do. You're the bell.
Oh, you did it, mate.
You really are. You're such a tuppence a pair, my friend. That's
tuppence
the
tuppence a bag.
Yeah, I said tuppence a pair.
I willfully, mate. You tell you I walk around with my pants down. I walk around with my pants down. I walk around with my pants down.
You don't own any pants, man.
I don't even have any,
you're
mate.
Just,
if I,
you're
even just if I had any,
nude
as
the day you
on.
Were born, my friend.
Mate, anyway, so...
Such a bell.
So they blow up Houses of Parliament and Big Ben, which is attached, apparently.
That's the bell.
I thought they were in separate bits.
Right, yeah.
What does he blow up at the beginning? Is that St. Paul's Cathedral?
No, he blows up something like the Houses of Justice or something. I can't remember the fucking...
Oh, that's it.
One of them things.
Everyone's come out with their masks and he blows up this thing. All the baddies are dead. What do you think everyone is doing the next day? Like, everyone's pristine somehow.
Yeah.
The beginning of the film has been it states, you're to blame. You've allowed this to happen.
Uh-huh.
And then there's no payoff to that very rich, rich, rich idea. Aside from everyone coming out with masks on, no one has to pay the piper or do any actual real work. I can't. These are all thick. These are thickos who will follow any other. No, listen, listen, listen. Uh-huh. What they've been living in this fascist state, being drilled with propaganda.
Uh-huh.
Oh, and suddenly they're awake. They need to rebuild. They need to rebuild and create a new society. How's that happening? They're not going to do that.
No, I mean, probably not. I mean, what will happen? And it's, you know, it's interesting that you say this, because this is always the interesting part of revolutions, isn't it? And it's a common theme, whatever way you look at it. I'm thinking of that. Remember that Bright Eyes song, Lure? Do you remember that song? Where he not the song Bright Eyes, Lure by the band Bright Eyes. The theme of that song is, you know, what looked so easy in the evening, by the morning, is a real drag. And that this is kind of true here as well, right? I can't sing it, but I'm thinking of it. I'm remembering vividly.
You could. You just won't. Don't say you can't.
No, I'm about to go on to a somber bit, though. So it would be inappropriate of me to sing it. In the evening by the morning, such a drag. I remember vividly scenes from the documentary The Square of, I can't remember the man's name, but he's a young student from Egypt who was one of the key messengers in the uprising, and he used Facebook and Twitter in order to galvanize lots of people who were already feeling the oppression of the state and wanting to do something about it, to come to Tahrir Square in Egypt and to occupy the square until such a time as the president resigned, right? And that was obviously a key part of the Arab Spring and the uprising that kind of spread across that region. I can't actually remember what year it was, but it was over a decade ago now. And obviously today, what we have in Egypt is another pretty totalitarian government crushes down on freedom of speech, and it's not particularly safe to be a journalist there, for example. It's not a fantastic place to be from that perspective. And one of the heartbreaking things about the Arab Spring and the revolution is that whilst you have this incredible groundswell at the time, this like unbelievable momentum of people coming out at great risk to their own safety, at great risk to their family's safety. In Viva Vendetta, you see them all approaching as a crowd, right? And that's often not the way it works. Normally, there are some people who've been there for a long time who are hugely persecuted, and they add more and more and more people over time, until such a time where the populace outweighs the number of possible authorities within the area. And there are these absolutely fantastic scenes of green laser pens shooting up at helicopters, and Tahrir Square just filled not just with students, but with members of the Muslim Brotherhood, with soccer ultras who were famously a really important part of the movement, all celebrating the fall of an authoritarian regime. And then what happens the next day, right? It's horrendous when you look back at it. And that's why you have scenes of this young man who was critical in the uprising, crying on live news, live Egyptian news, and saying he's sorry he didn't want anybody to get hurt. He's sorry to the mothers and fathers of the friends of his and the young people who were killed in the ongoing battle that continued throughout. And you know, then you have another decade of Egyptian political history to examine, to see what happened. Now, that's not me making a statement about whether that was a good thing or a bad thing, or whether things should have been done differently. Like, fuck if I know. I don't know. I wasn't part of that. I've never been part of anything like that. But you're absolutely right to identify that the next day, yeah, how does that work? And history shows us that it's not straightforward. It's never that there's some instant regime to take over, which is perfectly pluricratic, and you know, everything's liberal and democratic, and you know, it just doesn't work like that.
It is nice, and I've almost forgotten it, but the big thing that V says is, I can't push this button because I'm an angry, violent person.
Yeah,
the person who should push this button is the person who's going to be here.
Yeah,
after, like, I can't be a part of the world after. Again, it's got this whiff and whisper of, you know, this lovely idea that's kind of buried at the end. And like, you want it to be, I want that to be the through line.
Yeah.
You know, that's, and it's just also, it's
the through line is hope.
Lost.
I don't know that it is, though.
I don't want hope. No, because the film is completely, it's got the ideas there, and I realize why you connect with them, because they are there, and I don't want to say they're not, because they are. I'm just going to say they are there, and it's frustrating because a film needs to be simple and clear and have that idea run through like a bloody stick of rock, and you have that be the thing that V wrestles with. The idea that V decides not to push the button and like not be around for what's after, it doesn't land hugely. It's a really powerful idea, but it doesn't connect with the character or have any ramifications with who I understand I'm dealing with.
I would say that the through line of the film is about hope. That is referenced pretty regularly. I would say that the end of the film, which is the evening of, as opposed to the morning after, where you know, there is any potential to come afterwards, like that is a hopeful idea, and that is a moment of jubilation. That did happen in Takaria Square. That does happen historically at various different revolutions. It doesn't mean that it's not difficult the next day, but it also doesn't negate the fact that that is a significant chapter in any revolution, right? So the idea here, I think, is fairly libertarian to a certain extent. The film has made its values clear in that it decries the notion that people of different sexual preferences, for example, should be singled out. But in terms of what is to come next, I think the film is only concerned with the idea of potential and hope and relinquishing the chains that prevent hope from being there, right? Like, that's what the film cares about. What happens afterwards is anybody's guess.
I find that politically naive and fucking
why
just Hollywood nonsense. It's just like not specific enough.
No, I think, like, that's,
may as well just have a fucking
criticism.
Flock of white doves flown. Well, it's not unfair. That is, it is politically naive.
What do you want it to say? How does that?
I want it to be about something more. I want it to be concrete, because like people wearing that mask, I think there is no suggestion now that they want. There's nothing, no suggestion of what they want to replace it with.
Well, that's not about the film, though.
Hey, it is about the film, because that's why I think that is as much of a message of the film, is that you could just watch it and listen to what you want. Because it is unfortunately muddled enough for you to just tune into what you want to say. And I think the anarchist burn it all down, fuck authority message, which I love, man. Ooh, take that, the man. It's, you know, oh, I'm really up for that. But also, I think, but we're a society. I want us all to get along and figure out how to live together. That's what I want the message to be. How do we all live together and get on?
I think
and respect everyone.
I think you're asking too much of a film to do that. I think the idea that you would expect a film like this to do that is, that's the naivety, man. Like, you can't, how is it supposed to do that? Isn't it enough to, like,
don't exist. You don't exist. If you can't do that, fuck off.
Why? How could it do that? What film does that that also achieves, great, like, okay, Pride. What about Pride?
Interesting. Good.
So Pride, 2014 film, that's an absolutely fantastic film that centers around it's a delightful film. And it centers around the story of a small group of gays and lesbians who are living in the 70s in London. And they're trying to campaign for increased, you know, awareness and securities for gays and lesbians and everyone within society. One of their members decides that the best way to do this is to partner with another oppressed group of people under Thatcher, and that is Welsh miners. And so they start this campaign, which is gays and lesbians support the miners. They travel to Wales, to the valleys, to go and see the miners. And you can imagine the kind of culture clashes that take place with that film. It's a fucking beautiful film.
It's amazing, like that. It just sounds so obvious and so trite. It's such a sensitive, wonderful, funny, sad, uplifting, real film.
Mm-hmm.
As you're ever likely to see.
Yes,
it's ten
times better than V for Vendetta. Let's because it achieves the same thing. It has specificity. It has it's obviously it's happened historically, so it's easier for us to be able to say, well, that happened, so, you know, Adam can't disagree with its naivety. And there's this wonderful moment at the end of the film where it's Gay Pride Parade in London, and all of our gays are there and our lesbians are there too. And then who shows up?
They've been let down. They've been told they can't, that year, they don't want to make it Pride about something else. They don't want to make it political. So they're gonna shove the political gays.
The political gays go at the back because gays this year is now about like just being fun having gay. Fun. It's fun gays, yeah. Not political gays. But who should show up? About 600 Welsh miners show up, getting off these coaches, and they all stand at the front and they march the Pride march, holding the banners of solidarity. And the Billy Bragg plot song plays over the top, and it's a fucking wonderful cinema moment. And it means all the more that this really happened and that press groups of people supported each other. It earns it. The film earns it.
And even though nothing has changed and we live in a horrible, homophobic society that's crushed the working class.
Yeah.
You can still, you just watch it as a liberal and you just like see.
Well, that would be a criticism of the film, right? It is a liberal wet dream. It makes me feel, you know, like, oh, good things are happening. You know, well done me. I haven't done anything. I've done nothing, you know. And I'm a little bit confused about what my response to that is supposed to be. Although I will tell you that it honestly, just makes me cry with a mixture of sadness and happiness.
Can I say there's if for anyone who watched Pride, and I think it was very widely watched, if you watched that and loved it, you have to watch BPM, a French film from 2017. It's set in the 1990s, and it's about a group of young activists trying to raise awareness about HIV and AIDS. And like, if you wept at Pride, if you want the kind of if you want to kind of show off to your friends and be like edgier and even cooler, like if they say, "Oh, did you like Pride?" and you can go, "Well, yeah, I like Pride, but guess what? I liked BPM." I mean, that's more of a.
Can I stop and acknowledge something here, Adam? Yeah.
Yeah.
On this podcast here, we might not be able to enact or affect societal change, or we might not be able to, you know, rescue oppressed groups of people from the various different oppressors. But what I think me and the listeners have witnessed is an emotional journey that you have gone on, because you said at the beginning of this film podcast series that you do not recommend films for fear of rejection, for fear of being exposed based on what you've recommended. And yet here you are in the bosom of Pride, feeling all warm in the lovely feelings of solidarity and communion and hope and perspective. You here have recommended a film to me and to the audience of this podcast. And I think we should take a moment to give you a little round of applause for what a fantastic emotional arc you have been on. Well done to you for recommending a film. We're all proud of you. And no one's going to watch it.
It felt natural, and no one will, because they'll feel like it's oppressive.
It's actually a really weird film for you to recommend, and I think differently of you because you said it.
Except when you do, when you do. Hey, Joe, shall we play the box office game?
Oh, I'd love to play the box office game. Now, this is a real toughy wuffy, isn't it, Adam? Wouldn't you say? This is a little...
I don't think so.
No, you don't think so? Okay. No. Well, estimated brackets budget, please, for V for Vendetta.
So we're on the 2007s. So
2006 it came out, March. 2006.
Yeah, but you know, this is they've spent money. This is Warner Brothers. Mm. This is Joel Silver.
Yeah, it's the Wachowskis.
We didn't get to talk about Joel Silver at all.
I don't even know who that is.
He's a kind of a Jerry Bruckheimer type producer.
Oh. I don't know who that is either.
He produced the Matrix films. You do, because I told you who he was when we talked about King Arthur.
Oh, I've forgotten.
And you've forgotten. Yeah, great, obviously. Great.
It's
great.
Do you know what? I'm really sad that I can't remember anything, because I feel like I would have learned a lot from you over the last year or so. But a shame I haven't. Anyway, go on.
So you're talking 2007. It's a big old
2006.
No, it's set down as 2007.
Opening weekend, March 19th, 2006.
Why is Letterboxd said it was 2007?
Well, I would trust IMDb.
Yeah, but I've introduced it as 2007.
Well, that was inaccurate.
But don't need V for... Oh, I said 2005.
Oh, wow. You've just... you've sort of, you know, hit either side. Give it a pop in the middle.
Whatever. The mid-20s.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Whatever I said at the beginning, guys, ignore me. Mm-hmm. Don't point it out as a mistake.
No.
We're talking the mid-20s. It's a superhero flick. There's explosions. I'd say it's cost. Let's just go $100 million.
Oh, now.
No. I want to go back
now. You chastised me last week for offering you the opportunity to go back. Are you sure you want to go back?
I want to go back.
Because what does Thouest think of James McTeague et al. That they would spend $100 million on this film?
Yeah, no, I've already realised that. It looks like shit. Uh-huh. James McTeague is a first-time director. Uh-huh. It's a film about fascism. Uh-huh. I think they've spent 60.
Well, you are still too high, my friend, because they spent $54 million.
Oh, not estimated. Much. Hey, come on. That's not much higher.
Well, I mean... I'm taking your first answer of 100.
No, you're not, because I took it back.
But you said that your first answer is always locked in.
No, it's not, because you didn't say to me, do you want a new another win? Well, no, I did it myself.
All I'm saying is that I'd already made a noise which indicated that you were quite far away before you took it back.
Yeah, and I'd already said that I don't believe anything you say. So my take backs is pristine. My take back is pristine.
Okay, on the basis of a pristine take back... you're 6 million north of the budget, which is fine.
Thank you.
You are within the 10% allowance here. So just about. So that's pretty
just
good.
About.
Now, listen, opening weekend, US and Canada. What do you think, man? This is a toughie. Woofy.
This is a toughie because I think they're going to sell it big on the Wachowskis. They're not selling it big on McTeague.
Would you like to see The Matrix, but set in a futuristic and also historical fascist England?
Yes, please. No, thanks. No, Natalie Portman is not opening a film. As stunning as she is as an actress, she ain't opening nothing.
Okay.
This has got a face mask for a baddie. This is confusing. This is filled with British faces. Americans are going to be hugely baffled. What?
What?
Big Ben?
Big Ben?
What? Hey, Bob, what's going on over there? They got a movie about a giant man called Ben, and he blows up at the end. I don't know what's going on. Yeah, like, you know, this ain't doing diddly did.
Okay.
Diddly did. It's doing something. What is it? 60? Let's say 12.
Oh, well, Adam Richmond. I'm trying to make a noise to allow you to have a pristine take back and have another pop if you want.
No, I don't mind. This is tough. I didn't know. I think it could have gone buffo. It could have gone tanked.
Opening weekend, $25.6 million.
Okay. That's like jump. That's jumper territory.
I mean, it's pretty fucking good, man. Like that. I know.
It's not good. It's a solid. It's a good.
Listen, you know, we agreed whether we know or not.
I'm not saying
we know. I'm saying based on our own internal logic, our own contextual logic, we agreed that a third of budget on opening weekend was a really good take. This is more than that. This is more than that. This is over 40%. We're talking 45% of budget here. It's good. How dare you? How dare you try and mislead our listeners?
Based on our very ill-informed logic.
Yeah, that's fine, though. Okay, gross worldwide. What do you reckon gross worldwide for this one, then? $54 million budget, $26 million opening weekend.
Well, you know, Warner Brothers are pumping the old marketing dollars behind this, and the marketing could be anywhere from... I reckon they're spending the same. They're spending 50.
You've just decided.
Well, like, sometimes it's half and sometimes it's the same.
Let's see if Google tells us what they spent on marketing.
Don't you dare find out what they spent on marketing.
How much
they really,
did they spend on marketing?
Listen,
V for Vendetta.
Don't do this. You're going to ruin the game.
I'm not ruining
ruin
the game.
Game.
I'm not ruining
they
the
never,
game.
They never release those things. They never say how much. It's always guesstimations. And I hate that word. It's just estimations. They always do estimations based on like scuttlebutt and gossip.
Well, look, luckily for you, it's too hard to say. I can't find out. But go on. What do you reckon gross worldwide?
On the Wachowski name alone, Portman.
Portmanteau.
Portmanteau. It's made 25. It's made 150.
Well, it hasn't quite done that well. It's done 134. But again, you are just outside of the 10% range allowance there by 400,000.
You've invented that allowance.
Just as you've invented all the other things. Now, the 10% allowance will remain in effect for future films as well.
It won't. It will. I do not have to get that close.
No, you do. I've decided
no,
you
I
do.
No, I don't. I just have to be in the right vibe.
No, I've
if
decided
I'm in the right
you
vibe
do.
Space.
Because if sometimes what happens is I say, you know, you say 15 and I go, actually, it was 35. And you go, no, pretty close. Not that, but pretty happy about
that's
that.
Half, mate.
That's
fuck
half.
You,
that's half.
Don't. That's hard.
You've done that before. You've done that before.
I've not done 15 to 30.
You have. You have done that before, and you've said it was fine, and then you've shouted at me that it was fine.
That's old me.
I'm giving you a 10% range, and I'm saying it's sort of allowed within. You can have a 10% of the 10% as well. So in this instance, you've got your extra 400, 500. It's fine. You could have had another 1.5 mil. You were a mil within range.
Listen, I'll take 10%, right? If you start the convo with, this is hard.
Uh-huh.
You've got to add another 10%.
If I start, okay. So then we're going 20 for hard.
Yeah.
20% for hard.
Yeah.
And we both agreed this was hard.
You said hard. I fucked opening weekend. I'm going to wear that suit.
Sure.
But don't tell me I didn't land the budget. And don't tell me I didn't land the fucking gross worldwide.
Yeah, look,
I did.
You were 10% out for, well, actually, you were just over 10% out for budget because budget's 10%, additional percent was 5.5 million. So you were 500,000 out of the 10. And actually, you're 500,000 out of the 10 here, but the 20 encompasses all. So even for a hard, you still did a good job.
Listen, if I say 60 and it's 50, I win.
That's not what happened, though.
I said 60 and it was 55.
You said 60 and it was 54. Now, 10% is 5.4 million.
And I'm telling you what the rules are. The rules are, if I say 60 and it's 54, I win.
No, that's it.
I don't give a shit about 10%.
Telling you
listen,
that I care.
Listen,
and the audience care listen, too. Okay, so now let me just do the simple math for you here. Now, listen, 10% of 54, yeah, 5.4. What does that add up to? 59.4. What did you say? 60. It's just outside the 10%, but because we allowed 20, because it was a hard game, you still
you
win.
You said hard game.
I said it's a hard game.
Game. You
so you still
game.
Win. So I don't know what you're complaining about. All I'm saying is that you were outside the 10%. So if it wasn't a hard game, you would have lost. Luckily for you, it was a hard game. And I'm never going to say that again. I only said that to be nice. But in future, there'll be no hard games unless it's really hard. And you would have lost this one. That's all I'm saying. You want
to
do better.
According to
if
who?
You don't want
to
feel, according to me
who?
And the audience, if you want to feel better about your performance, you have to work harder, okay? This is episode, 15 of the podcast? It's not baby time anymore, mate. It's not time for you to be saying you don't know the answer or you're not an expert. This is time you should have knuckled down and got this right, okay? We've been doing this for a year.
If I start doing homework, it ruins the thing.
It's not homework, mate. It's just
it's vibe. The whole
reaping
game is
what
vibe.
You sow. That's
no,
all it is.
The whole game. Listen, the whole game is vibe.
No.
Did I get the? No. Listen. Mm-hmm. Listen. Uh-huh. I'll tell you what the game.
I'm told.
Is.
I've
the
told you what the game is.
The game is. Do I have a sense of the vibe? Okay, a sense.
That sounds like an interesting game. What game is that? Because it's not this one.
The game is, listen, I'm not Johnny Box Office.
Yes, you are.
I didn't study, listen, I did, listen, take that
you're
back.
You're Adam
I
the Box Office Richmond.
I did not study the facts. I don't give a shit about how much money it took. The whole point of this game is you get to say some facts.
I did not
and
study
I get
the
to kind
facts.
Of, and I get to get kind of like estimate from a rough sense of like, you know, and say a number and it's fun. If you put this 10% bullshit,
don't worry.
Like,
I'll never say it again. But I have to say, after this conversation, the audience will all remember that there's an unspoken 10% margin. So even if I don't say it, the cat's out of the bag, man. they'll know. Also, lovely nickname for you. Adam, I haven't studied the facts, Richmond. That's really good.
But the thing is, I do. Here's the thing. And when I say that to my wife, she goes fucking ballistic. Oh, here's the thing, is it? Here's the thing. Are you going to tell me the thing? That's the most masculine thing you can say. Here's the thing. You're going to tell me what the thing is? Yeah. Here's the thing. Yeah. Yeah, here's the thing.
Meanwhile, here you're holding a piece of paper that has the thing written on it and you're flapping it in her face, yeah?
I'm holding a copy of the Blu-ray of The Thing, yeah, directed by John Carpenter, and going, here's the thing. Well, let's watch The Thing. I love this. No, it's the thing is...
What is the thing?
I don't mind missing, right? So 10%, how about this? You're right, okay? Mm-hmm. I'm going to row it right back.
Okay.
10%, if you're not guessing, because you've got a fucking backbone made out of mayo. Like, I'm putting my reputation on the line. Okay, listen, I'm happy. Mm-hmm. If I'm getting... To do a victory lap, I've got to be within 10% of at least two. Okay, and if I'm a smidge out or a smidge under, that's fine.
Yeah, sure.
I'll take that.
It's fine, but you can't victory lap.
I'll take the bronze medal.
Yeah,
no victory lap allowed.
Low podium appearance. I'll humble, that's fine.
And I would be, you know, I'm happy to just be in the game.
On the flip side, of course. If you are going to take a victory lap for an excellent guess, when you guess outside, when you guess badly, you will have to take a loser's lap, okay? That's just fair.
But you were always fucking doing this. Like,
you were always doing this.
You never
even from the beginning of our relationship.
Fair Jew.
Yeah.
Listen, this is good.
Yeah.
Fair, listen.
Yeah.
I think...
Hey, before we play the guess the next movie game, Adam, I've got a little tweet here that I'd like to share with you.
Tell me more.
I will tell you more. This tweet is from Jérémy Toulalon. That's how I like to say his name in my head. It is Jérémy Toulalon. And Jérémy...
Which episode is it about?
This is about the last episode that went out. So what was that about then? Oh, Logan, wasn't it? It was about Logan, this one. Some time ago now. Jérémy says, a very compelling listen. Please pass on to Adam, though, that I reject current day superhero movies entirely, but not as a genre as much as a style. It's like being in 1890 and loving Impressionism, thus rejecting academicism entirely because it's incompatible with my taste. It's not a genre thing. This 1890 self of mine likes, say, mythological paintings as long as they're done by Auguste Renoir. I can't say all these people that he's saying, and Henri Matisse, instead of Jean-Léon... Why, he's just said this to make me say all hard names, hasn't he? Jean-Léon Jérémy and his ilk. Similarly, I liked superhero movies from the 70s and to the 90s. They were something else. I've butchered that, Jérémy. Sorry about that. But Adam, you get the point, right? Because you were saying that anyone that rejects all superhero movies is a big bellboy.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you got this tweet because he's spot on. I doff my cap to this because the what I forgot to mention in the Logan episode where we were talking about Marvel, even though it's not a Marvel movie, is that Marvel movies do have notoriously this kind of similar aesthetic. They have a similar kind of color grading, and they do all kind of blend into each other. And if aesthetically, sometimes they get to pop. The James Gunn ones pop a bit more, but generally they kind of all just flatten out into a little bit of a bland vibe. Mm-hmm. And
a little mushroom soup.
I think it's, yeah. We never got onto what my favorite Marvel movies were. For me, Blade. Is Blade and Blade 2 are the best ones?
They Marvel movies.
They are. I mean, they're Blade. They're not made. They're not technically under the house of Marvel.
What is that trolley lady doing, by the way? Has the Hogwarts Express, did you get to Hogwarts 45 minutes ago? Now she's cleaning up or something, because she's really going to town on those magical dishes.
She's heard that Marvel movie. Yeah, yeah, yeah. She just wants to like step all over it. So anyway, it's a really good point. It's absolutely spot on. I had not considered the aesthetic factor, and I'm going to row back on it because I think it's a strong enough point to kind of dismiss them wholesale. But if you're going to, you know, that was me kind of being quite just assuming that people, when they say Marvel, mean all comic books. And I was being fairly like unforgiving. Maybe people do just mean Marvel movies, and they do have that aesthetic that it's very dismissible.
No Marvel films, no comic books. That's what I had in my head, which when you were talking then. No superheroes in the hooks.
I don't think you're going to get a better looking superhero movie than, say, Watchmen. And that's your man, Zack Snyder. And whatever you say about Zack Snyder, he shoots the fucking shit out of stuff.
Right.
It looks gorgeous. Looks amazing.
Haven't seen it.
Blade looks fantastic. Blade 2, Guillermo del Toro.
Haven't seen that either.
Superb. Sam Raimi, if you include Darkman, which is technically a superhero film, is kind of fun and grungy in 80s. He probably means the Superman movies with Christopher Reeve, which do look great because they were shot on film, but are quite kind of boring.
I thought he meant the Adam West Batman.
No, because he said the 80s and 90s.
He said the 70s and the 80s and the 90s.
Did he?
He did.
No. He didn't.
Yep, he said from the 70s to the 90s.
Oh, he did from the 70s. That's the thing. It's very easy for him to say that because there aren't actually that. There's not that many.
It sounds like it's an easy thing for him to say. I think you should dig into him a bit more. This guy sounds like he's not a good person.
No, he's nailed it. He's the aesthetic thing is such a spot-on point. Yeah.
I didn't like his point. I thought his point was weak.
Hey, Joe, do you want to play the bit of the game where we try and catch each other out with the next film title for the next movie? This is the bit of the podcast where one of us lists movies that the other one has tried to catch them out in the forgot they forgot them game. this time, it's going to be me reading out films. Dead Presidents.
I've never seen it.
Gangs of New York.
I haven't forgotten that, really. I mean, like, I've seen it a number of times. It's a bit boring. I don't know. I don't know if I want to do it. I'd love to do another Leo at some point, but not this one.
Two Faces of January. The Two Faces of January.
Wow. That's a Patricia Highsmith, right?
Yeah.
I fucking loved that film. And I have completely forgotten that existed. Is that going to make a good episode?
Tell you what, mate.
We could do all of Highsmith, couldn't we?
It doesn't matter whether it would make a great episode. I fucking squished you.
Yeah. Did I say that to you?
No. I've been holding on to that for ages.
That's a really good one, man. I remember I saw that in the cinema and I adored that film. I have seen it once since, but quite a long time ago. Oh, we could talk about The Talented Mr. Ripley as well. We could even talk about the John Malkovich one. Ripley's Game. Let me say, and I haven't said this before because I haven't wanted to impress myself upon the listeners, but if you haven't seen The Two Faces of January and you have time before next week's episode or whenever, maybe watch it before, because it's so good. It's worth watching anyway, and it might be worth, it's one of those where maybe it's worth watching before we spoil it. So either watch it or skip it, I would say, until you've watched it.
Punchy. This is unprecedented. Unprecedented. Joe Devine, he's not just recommended a movie. He's flopped his dick out and said, don't listen to the episode.
And let me just tell you, it is Viggo Mortensen, it's Kirsten Dunst, it's Oscar Isaacs, and it's a Patricia Highsmith film. It's so good. If you like The Talented Mr. Ripley, or if you don't, even if you like that sort of vibe, the Americans in old Europe vibe, get on this film or skip the episode.
And yet, you forgot it.
It's one of those ones, man. It's just one that's like, you know, you have these. There's one or two a year. You go to the cinema, you see something, you leave and you think, that was terrific. That was really good. And then you never think about it again. And this is one of those films for me.
I mean, it's a sweet, sweet bullseye for this podcast. Yeah. Sometimes we get it wrong. We ain't got it wrong this time.
It's perfect. Well done. Well done to you. I take everything back I said in the box office game. You've nailed it. There was no 10% about that, mate. That was 100.
Say goodbye, Joe.
Goodbye, Joe.
All right. Goodbye. See you later.